We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson, our technical director today, Kyle Mabry. Today we open the phone lines and the email message folder for questions about diet and nutrition. Our guest is licensed registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. At the end of January, the Departments of Health and Human Services and Agriculture released new dietary guidelines for Americans. One guideline is to fill half our plates with vegetables and fruits. And for many of us, that may seem a tall order. So one of the topics we'll take up this morning, getting more fruits and vegetables into our meals. Susan is also happy to field whatever you have on your mind in terms of diet and nutrition this morning, whatever your questions might be. We look forward to your phone calls and email messages. The phone number's in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Susan is an adjunct lecturer with the University of Illinois Food Science and Human Nutrition Department. She's a sports and wellness nutritionist and president of Nutrition on the Move, and she is the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. She also happens to be the sports dietitian for Illini Athletics and leads nutrition and cooking classes at the ARC, the Activities and Recreation Center at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and will-talk@illinois.edu. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Good morning.
And happy National Registered Dietitian Day. Right?
That's right. Thank you very much. It's a day during the, this is National Nutrition Month, so March is always a good time to kind of think about your diet and think about nutrition and what you're doing. And then as of the last few years, they've recognized registered dietitians one day during that month. So it happens to be today.
Are there any particular activities that go on during National Nutrition Month?
Well, there are. The various dietetic associations may have different things going on. A lot of times at hospitals, the dietitians will have different things happening. We've had a few cooking classes and different things going on through the month. And so usually there are some things. And then the American Dietetic Association, whose website is just www.eatright.org, has a lot of new materials coming up on that website during the month and recommendations for, of course, eating well, recipes. There's some good information on there right now about helping kids eat more fruits and vegetables and tips and ways to do that. So from a national standpoint, that's a big help as well.
What's been the reaction so far to the new dietary guidelines for Americans from dietitians?
Well, I think dietitians overall are really pleased with the recommendations. One of the things we've seen over the years, it seems like the dietary guidelines have moved from don't do this to do this. And still there's recommendations in the guidelines of not, you know, what not to eat and what not to do. But it seems like there's more kind of a positive approach of what we can do and what we should be eating and how to do that a little bit more easily. Excuse me. And I think the other thing that we're noticing is just more of a focus on being active and more of a focus on watching portions and really looking at that intake versus output. I think for many years, the guidelines would come out and they'd have general recommendations, but they weren't necessarily as specific to watching the amount and watching the calories. And as we know, one of the big concerns for Americans is the fact that people, it's very easy to eat too many calories. It's just very simple. You know, it's very, very easy to do that when you go to a restaurant. Maybe an entree would be 1,000 calories. That's not unusual. And for many people, if they're trying to lose weight or drop a little bit, their needs may be 1,500 or even a little bit less per day. So it's very You can get those calories on really quickly. And so that's one of the goals is to, like you mentioned, really look at when you are eating, what does your plate look like? Do you have half of that plate with fruits and vegetables? And that's a simple way, obviously, to cut down calories and also to get more overall nutrition. You know, if there's one thing we know about what you can eat and how it can help you, it's the idea that eating more produce really does decrease the risk of many diseases. And that's a simple thing we can really fall back on.
Yeah. It seems for some time we were saying five a day.
Mm-hmm.
And now it seems this is more.
Right.
Is it quite a bit more?
It ends up being more. If we look at the recommendations of, trying to get, let's say, 2 cups of fruit at least and 3 cups of vegetables a day or more, you know, that's actually 5 cups. And in some ways, the servings ended up being, well, maybe a half a cup would be a serving or something. So what we're saying now is that volume should really be higher. It should be increased. And there's a really nice tool online, which is new, and that's part of the My Pyramid. So if you would go to www.mypyramid.gov, they've got some special areas on there that really focus on the different food groups. And so if, let's say, for example, I printed off one to look at the vegetables. So if you look at the vegetable food groups now, it'll list all kinds of vegetables in different colors, because one of the goals, too, is to try to eat different colors. And that's one of the main themes for National Nutrition Month through the American Dietetic Association is fill your plate with color. And I'm not talking about green M&Ms, but, you know, just the idea that we got a lot of produce, a lot of different colors. But on there, there's a little tab that says View Vegetable Food Gallery. And you can click on that gallery online, and it'll bring up all these different vegetables and what a serving looks like, which is really helpful for people.
Yeah.
And so that's a new tool that one of the pluses is really, let's say, what does it really look like to get enough in? And I think you're exactly right. We just weren't eating enough.
Okay. Well, we've got a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's go and take this call now from a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yes. Excuse me. I wanted to find out about glucosamine. I don't know. There's glucosamine sulfate, glucosamine chondroitin, and I wonder, is it necessary to have it for bones, or which kind is best?
Well, glucosamine in many studies has been helpful for decreasing kind of the way the body breaks down the tissue, or particularly osteoarthritis, or if you're having joint problems, and that's really what it's marketed for. And there have been some controversial studies. There have been studies to find that glucosamine, no matter what form it's in, helps some people, particularly if the arthritis seems to be worse or if the problems seem to be more painful. For some people, it may help more. For people with just general concerns, it may not. I think from a formatting standpoint, the key thing is actually getting the glucosamine itself. Most of the studies have been on glucosamine sulfate. That's kind of the history of a lot of the studies.
Okay.
But getting in glucosamine 1,500 milligrams a day is what most of the studies have looked at. And we always say to people, if you want to try that, take it for a good 6 weeks or 8 weeks consistently and take enough of it. Take the 1,500 milligrams to be able to see if it does seem to help you. So for some people, it really doesn't help. For other people, they really do feel it seems to help. And a lot of those studies were actually on osteoarthritis of the knee, but not to say it wouldn't help in other areas. And so the other thing to keep in mind is that glucosamine in some people, if they have high blood sugar or if they have diabetes or on medications for that, glucosamine, you can think of it, the name glucose. Glucosamine is kind of a carbohydrate-based or sugar-based product. So for some people, there have been cases where it's actually raised blood sugar. So that's one caveat that we should kind of mention, just because for some people that can cause some problems. But I would be most concerned that it's actually glucosamine, not as concerned about the form, except knowing that most of these studies were on glucosamine sulfate.
Okay.
And then also making sure they're getting enough. I have a lot of clients who'll come in, or people come in with questions, and they say, well, I'm taking glucosamine, doesn't seem to work, but they're only taking maybe 500 milligrams. Or if you look in the stores, many of them, if they say they're double strength, often that'll be the 1,500 milligrams.
Right. Yeah.
So making sure you're taking enough of that actual glucosamine. There have been studies that have looked at the different way it's formatted, formatted with chondroitin or without. But I would be just most concerned about getting glucosamine in the right amount.
Okay. Also, the calcium. What? I don't know. That comes from all different kinds of things. This bottle I have says it's from algae.
Mm-hmm.
Does it make any difference? Is some more available than other? I mean, calcium.
Yeah. Well, with calcium too, it kind of depends on the format. We know that it's most well absorbed generally if the calcium has vitamin D with it. So I guess I would look
right.
at that and make sure. Usually there's 400. I use a vitamin D with it. And as far as the calcium, whether it's carbonate or citrate, again, there are studies showing one might be a little bit better for some people, another one. I would just kind of make sure you're getting enough calcium,
okay.
which we know that about 500 or 600 milligrams at a time is probably the most you want to take for absorbability's sake. If you take more than that, you're just not going to absorb as high a percentage of the calcium. It's too much at one time because it's such a big mineral.
Okay. Very good. I don't know. This jar says vitamin D3. I didn't know there were numbers on D.
Yeah, well, there's different vitamin, D preparations. And generally with vitamin D, you want to make sure that you're getting a well-absorbed form and you want to make sure you're taking the right amount. If you're taking vitamin D, one thing that we're seeing now in a lot of the studies is that if you're taking vitamin D, you want to make sure that you really need vitamin D, because for some people they've increased the amount of vitamin D and they may or may not need it. So too much vitamin D is not necessarily good. And so generally when we look at vitamin D, we'll see vitamin D3 as a format of that. But generally, if it's a well-absorbed form, it's 400 to 800 IUs or something. If people are low, the intake amount needs to be considerably higher.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you.
Thank
You're
you.
You're welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. If you'd like to talk with registered dietitian Susan Kundrat, we also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. What is the current recommendation for calcium and for D?
Well, calcium will range from 1,000 to 1,500 milligrams
okay.
a day. And that's kind of for general health purposes. For many people, if they've got osteoporosis or have other problems, they may be recommended to take 2,000 milligrams. Vitamin D, there are different recommendations that are out there now, but usually it's 800 to 1,000 mm-hmm. IUs in food and supplements together.
Mm-hmm.
Most time, if something is supplemented, it's usually supplemented with 400 IUs. And really, like we've talked about in the past, the big thing with vitamin D is people really need to just know what their level is, to have it checked, see if they need additional amounts. And I would say that I don't know that there's any hard and fast rule. We're looking at this with athletes to see if their vitamin D is low, really how much should they take in. Right now I'm compiling data from a lot of different universities in terms of their protocols and what they're doing, and they're varied. Not everybody's doing the same thing when vitamin D is low. And so I think there's still a lot we need to learn. I'm going to a conference this weekend, actually, a sports nutrition and wellness mm-hmm. conference in Chicago, and one of the speakers will be speaking on vitamin D, and next month I'm going to another one. One of the talks is on vitamin D, so that'll be good. I think there's a lot of emerging research there.
Okay. So probably this is something that you want to discuss with your physician when you have your checkup.
Exactly.
It was interesting. I had an eye exam last week, and they wanted to know what kind of supplements I was taking, and I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just taking, a multivitamin.
Yeah.
But I thought that was a good thing.
It is
for people to ask.
It's very important, and I think we're learning more and more about how nutrition affects all kind of things, but certainly how certain nutrients and antioxidants would affect the eye and affect your risk of having macular degeneration,
mm-hmm.
and even things of how vitamin E or omega-3s, now there's a lot of interest in that and how that may keep the eye a little bit more moist, and so that might be a lot better for people. And so that's good.
Let's take another couple of calls. First, we go to Champaign Line 1. Hi.
Hi. I had a question. I know you talk a lot about protein, and if you could give a rule of thumb for how much protein is needed for breastfeeding moms and for preschoolers, like 3-year-olds. 3 to 5-year-olds?
Sure. Well, if you look at breastfeeding moms, the protein intake is up a little bit from your general recommendation. And if we back up and say, well, how much would you need if you weren't breastfeeding? Then kind of for the typical active person, you would take your weight and you'd divide it in half. So let's say if you're 160 pounds, you divide it in half, and that'd be 80 grams of protein. And then generally we try to add another 15 or 20 grams of protein to that when you're pregnant or breastfeeding. So take your weight, divide it in half, and then add maybe another 20 grams of protein, and that would give you an amount to make sure that you're getting enough, maybe even a little extra, which is good, that your protein needs are high enough. And then you want to kind of look at, well, what quality proteins are you taking in, particularly when you're breastfeeding, that you want to have a good, you know, good range of amino acids. And certainly if you do eat meat and drink milk and those things, we want more of those types of foods because they're really quality amino acids that will help form tissues and help your baby. The other thing to look at for protein may be, you know, we have recommendations now when you are breastfeeding to try to make sure you're getting enough omega-3s. And omega-3 fatty acids, of course, we know a lot more now than we did even 10 years ago about how important they are for brain development for a baby. And so for many people, you know, getting in some fish or getting in some flax or some things where you're going to get some of these omega-3s is very helpful too.
Okay. And for young children?
For young children, it will vary. Usually protein intake is not a problem if you just follow a simple rule for young children, and that would be when they're eating, you know, when you have the plate set out, if you're trying to have three or four different food items that maybe are a quarter cup each, that would be kind of range for a toddler or even a young child. And one of those, at least one of those, is a protein food. Maybe that's chunks of chicken or maybe that's beans or something like that. And for three meals, they're getting one of those and they're still getting their recommendations of milk or soy milk, which would be about three cups a day.
Okay.
Then they'll easily meet the protein needs. You know, that would be 40, 50 grams of protein a day or maybe even more by doing
okay.
that. So I wouldn't worry so much about the amounts as I would just to make sure when they're eating something, there's some protein food there, slice of cheese, again, you know, a little bit of fish, something with protein, and then that they are definitely getting the recommendations for milk intake or soy milk intake. That's what they take in of those three servings a day, three cups a day, milk, yogurt, again, the cheese, things like that. And then probably there's going to be no issue with protein.
Okay. And if you have a child that really doesn't eat well, you know, you set out protein foods, but they don't mm-hmm. get chosen that much, do you have recommendations about that?
Well, sure. I mean, I think you find things that they would eat. I mean, even some kids, maybe they wouldn't eat meat because of the texture. That can be a really tricky thing, or maybe beans because of the texture. But usually for young kids, it's more of a texture thing than anything else. And so the first thing I would do is try to vary the texture that you have. I mean, some kids won't eat a chunk of chicken, but they'll eat sliced chicken, for example, because it's easier mm-hmm. to eat. Or they may not eat beans if they're just regular beans, but if you mash them up or if you have hummus or something like that, they'll eat it because it's creamier. So I guess those would be the first things I'd look at. And then I'd also look at making sure you're adding some higher protein grains. Kids usually
okay, right.
love things like whole wheat pasta or quinoa or rice or things like that. So you're maybe bumping up those proteins, peanut butter, you know, that kind of thing where those proteins are maybe higher if they're not eating meats. And then I would still really focus on milk or soy milk because, you know, a cup of milk is 8 grams of protein. So if we're trying to get kids, you know, around 40 or 50 grams of protein, then a cup of milk is almost a quarter of that.
Sure.
Or cheese or yogurt or some of those other sources. You know, a good resource, too, for you would be I would go on that. We mentioned the mypyramid.gov.
Right.
And the nice thing about that now is that you can get on there and put in a kid's age and recommendations, and it'll come up with servings. And then it'll also come up with ideas for those servings. And so that's a really nice website that they've continued, you know, the USDA's continued to bump that up in terms of what they have available. And I like the fact that you can go through all the different food groups. Protein foods is listed. It'll give you all a list of all kinds of things that you might not even think of. And then you can, again, kind of look at the food gallery for those foods and see, oh, maybe we'll try this. I don't think this would work.
Okay.
And that would be a big help, too.
Okay. Great. Thank you, sir, very much.
You're welcome. Next, we go to a listener in Bond County on line 4. Good morning.
Good morning. What is your opinion of high fructose corn syrup?
Well, I think obviously it has been in the news a lot, particularly the last 4 or 5 years. Seems like it's not as much this year or the last 12 months or so as it had been. But high fructose corn syrup, of course, is used to sweeten all kinds of things, from bread to cookies to just about anything you can imagine. But what we know about high fructose corn syrup, I don't really subscribe to the idea that it's high fructose corn syrup that's made our company or our country obese. I don't think it's just that, or that necessarily is totally a bad thing. I think that I would treat that just like I would treat any other sugars. In other words, you wouldn't want to add a whole lot of just regular table sugar, just like you wouldn't want to add a lot of things to your diet that are sweetened with high fructose corn syrup. So in and of itself, I think it's, you know, probably no worse than other sugars, in my opinion. That's not everyone's opinion, but that's mine. And so if you think, well, I get once in a while I eat something that's got some high fructose corn syrup, especially if it's farther down on the label, I wouldn't worry too much about that. You know, the big concern was the fact that people were eating so many sweetened things that is contributing to our problem with weight gain. And there's no question about that. No matter what the sweetness or what the fat comes from, that's definitely a problem. But I wouldn't necessarily just say I'm never going to eat high fructose corn syrup. Again, some people believe that, and you'll see some things on TV on those lines. But the whole idea of trying to cut down on high fructose corn syrup is really much more about trying to eat more wholesome foods. And it's saying that, well, I'm going to cut down on some of these processed preservative foods, and I'm going to go more for fresh meats and fruits and vegetables and whole grains that really aren't sweetened ahead of time. And that idea is right on track. And so I think kind of moving towards that idea and kind of cutting out some of those foods that are sweetened, no matter what they're sweetened with, is a really important thing that we need to focus on. And that's, I guess that would be my focus.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this morning. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. If you'd like to talk with Susan Kundrat, we also have an email address you could use and drop us an email. And that is will-talk@illinois.edu. I noticed that one of the new guidelines from the government that came out at the end of January, drink water, calorie-free beverages like coffee and tea, and 100% fruit juice instead of regular sodas, fruit drinks, and energy drinks. So clearly they're taking note that we have a sweet tooth, and when it comes to having a soda, sometimes they can be really very high in calories because they're so large.
Right, and that really comes into that whole amount area. I mean, it is difficult to get a 12-ounce soda unless you buy it in its container. But if you're going to a supermarket or if you're going to get gas or something and you get those containers, I mean, a lot of those are 40 or 60-ounce drinks. And so the amount of sugar in that, and some of those could be a half cup to a cup of sugar in mm-hmm. those drinks. And so that's exactly right. And I think that it has become so much of our culture to have these sweetened drinks that people need to stop and think, wow, maybe I don't need all that. I should be drinking more regular water.
Yeah, I wonder if we've become accustomed to sweet things.
Oh, I think so.
So that's what we're looking for. And, you know, I guess going way back to our ancestors, sweet was something we were drawn to. We've always mm-hmm. been drawn to mm-hmm. it, but I suspect that maybe there's a sweet element in so many foods today.
Right. And I think we get, like you say, I think the body gets used to that, and we want that, we crave that. There's no question that most people, if I'm working with clients and we're trying to drop down the sweets that they're taking in, mm-hmm. most people will say once they get used to not eating that much sugar, they yeah. don't find it so difficult, but it just is that transition period that's hard.
That's what we hear about salt as well.
Exactly, exactly.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Urbana. Line one, hi.
Hi. On the subject of the high fructose, what I'm wondering in reading ingredients, first of all, I can't find a sugar that doesn't have a cereal that doesn't have it in it. And if you go into the health food cereals, they still have sugar added. So it's kind of hard to avoid sugar because of that. That's one thing. But also, if you read ingredients, they will mention high fructose, they'll say corn syrup, and then they'll have, comma, high fructose corn syrup. And then later on, they'll say high fructose corn syrup and corn syrup again. And what is the difference between corn syrup and high fructose corn syrup?
Well, you know, from a chemistry standpoint, I don't think I'm the expert on that. But what I do know is that many sweeteners that have been used for a while have been kind of high fructose corn syrup based sweeteners. In other words, they have a lot of fructose. When you say high fructose corn syrup, it's going to have fructose. Generally, it has other sugars in it too. And it just, the percentages might vary of how much is fructose and how much is something else. And so if you have corn syrup, that would be kind of the sweetener directly from corn, which would generally, you know, may have other sugars in it too. It, the percentages may be different. And so,
yeah, I guess my question is they're listed separately, corn syrup and high fructose corn syrup.
Right, and they're often listed separately because they're not quite the same ingredient, so they have to list them separately. They have to take them out. But like you mentioned, a lot of times if people just look for high fructose corn syrup, and then they may be missing the fact that there are four sugars in front of that, and the product is very high in, it may be very high in sugar, even if the high fructose corn syrup is not listed or if it's listed at the end. And my belief is that it's really more the factor of how much overall sugar we're getting in, no matter what it's coming from. And like you mentioned with the cereals, most cereals are sweetened because that's what we're used to eating now. But if you go to something like, that's why it's a benefit to go to something like plain oatmeal or plain whole grain cereals that don't have any sugar added, but you could add it. I mean, even if you add a teaspoon of sugar to oatmeal or a teaspoon of brown sugar, for many people, that's going to be sweet enough. And that's actually, you know, just 4 grams of sugar, whereas a lot of sweetened cereals will have, you know, we try to encourage people to get one with, you know, 10 grams of sugar or less, preferably less than that. But many sweetened cereals will have 15 grams of sugar, maybe more when you look at what an actual serving is. And so 4 grams is about a teaspoon. So that's a good rule of thumb, I think. That's reasonable. And that would be something that you might normally add and get plenty of sweetener if you were having oatmeal or something like that yourself. So that's the benefit of trying to buy it in its natural form if you can. And then adding the sweetener yourself, definitely.
Okay, and on a slightly different subject, how do you get tested for your level of, say, vitamin D3?
Well, if you look at your level, it's just going to be a regular blood test that can be added to other tests that you might normally have. So let's say if you're going in and you're having your normal blood work to check your lipids or check your blood sugar or things like that, it's just another test they add on to that.
Okay.
So if you're getting blood drawn and D is added to that testing, then that's what they'll do. They'll just take another little vial and they'll do that D test at the same time.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much.
Next, we talk with a listener in Arcola on line 2. Hi.
Hello?
Hi there.
I just lost you for a minute. I had a question about the quality of drinking water and how that affects the development of the brain. I know my wife worked for Doctors in Decatur for many years. And at one point, they all started adding water drinking systems, and then we started getting the notices of the nitrates in the water. So I was just curious about the quality of water and brain development. And I'm driving down the road, so I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay.
Well, I think we're always concerned about water quality, and that's why there's consistent kind of water testing and people looking at that. I think there's all, you know, every now and then there'll be an article in the paper about water testing and people found this or found this in their well or things. And some of these minerals in particular that might be in water can cause trouble with brain development or cause other problems. So that's a real big, you know, that's a big question, is trying to make sure, are you in an area wherever you live where you can find out the quality of your water, see if you can find out what the recent testing was on that and make sure that the water you're drinking is good. I mean, there's a lot of controversy too about, you know, fluoride in water or not in water and all those kinds of things. And is it too much or not enough? And so I'm not sure that all those questions have been answered, but that is a definite thing that we need to think about. We tell people to drink more water, but we also need to make sure that they're drinking the right kind of water, or that it's water that's going to be you know, appropriate and not have other contaminants in it.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Peoria. Line 4, hi.
Hello. I wanted to ask about another item, and that is salt. and I see on processed foods, I'm not sure how the calculations are made that a certain percentage of your daily needs for salt per serving. But when you add those things all up, you're way over the daily needs. What does this additional salt mean?
Well, that's an important thing that we're looking at. And in fact, in the, you know, if we go back to the new dietary guidelines, one of the recommendations, though actually the first, you know, key recommendations on food and food components to reduce, says that reducing daily sodium intake to less than 2,300 milligrams, that's about a teaspoon of salt,
okay,
is that amount of sodium, further reduce intake to 1,500 milligrams among persons who are 51 and older, because there's a much higher risk of high blood pressure, and those of any age who are African-American or have hypertension, diabetes, or chronic kidney disease. So it's much more specific in these dietary guidelines because we know, you know, certain age, we tend to be higher risk for high blood pressure or problems. We know that certain groups tend to be higher disease status for hypertension or diabetes or maybe kidney disease or things like that. And so that is not very much salt when you look at 1,500 milligrams of sodium or even 2,300 milligrams of sodium. Studies will vary, but many studies indicate we eat 3,000 to 4,000 milligrams of sodium a day typically, and certainly more for people who eat out a lot or particularly eating fast food and things like that. So I think, again, it kind of gets back to saying, well, if you're really going to watch your sodium, there are a couple things you have to do. One is you really have to eat foods that aren't as processed because, as you say, you might have a serving of canned soup, and that could be 1,000 milligrams right there.
Yeah, that's right.
And so
per serving, so per serving.
Exactly. And so, you know, one serving might be a cup, but, hey, that soup is good, and you're having two cups. So you'd be over your limit right there. So that presents more challenges, and I think for dietitians, that presents opportunities and challenges for us. I think, you know, one thing I've done in my career through the years is I do so much more cooking now with people, and shopping tours and trying to help people actually know how to cook meals. I mean, that's a lot of things that my interns do with me to help prepare foods and help people use fresh ingredients. And this whole push that we've seen towards more local food and buying food before it's processed is great because obviously those foods tend to be very low in sodium. And so I think that that's going to be something that we need to put a lot more emphasis on is basic cooking without a lot of salt, you know, making sure people understand where the sodium is in foods. And, of course, there's been a big push lately for restaurants to cut down the amount of sodium and for food producers to decrease sodium. So we've seen that moving in, which is really, really good. Because a lot of times the low-sodium products are higher in cost. And so we want to try to, you know, just get foods that are generally lower in sodium to begin with. And so the sodium is a challenge. And as our recommendations call for lower and lower amounts of sodium intake, at the same time people are eating more and more preserved foods. So that's going to be something to really, really pay attention to.
Okay, thank you for the information.
You're welcome. Next we take a listener call from someone on a cell phone, line one. Hi.
Hello. I had a two-part question. One was about the three common non-caloric sweeteners, aspartame, saccharin, and Truvia. And I recently read a study about there's a theory that drinking a lot of sugar-free sodas and foods desensitize the satiety center in the brain,
mm-hmm,
because it expects a carb load when it gets something sweet, and when you don't get the load, it just desensitizes to it, and could have some impact on overeating. And I'll list it offline.
Okay. Well, no, that's an excellent thing to bring up because we have seen in some studies where people take in more sugar-free items or sweetened items with artificial sweeteners and don't necessarily decrease their total caloric intake. And so, you know, there's some concern that getting these artificially sweetened foods actually increases your need for more calories or to feel satisfied. And I haven't, you know, read that exact study that you mentioned, but that is one of the issues is does the body then react in a way where it would normally be getting carbohydrates but it's not getting carbohydrates. So what happens then? And I think that gets back to your point, Celeste, that we're just so used to having sweetened things all day long, so much sweet during the day, that that's what the body, that's what we kind of want or expect. Mm-hmm. And so I have kind of a recommendation that I give my clients that I think is reasonable, and that is that if you have a, whether it's a sweetened beverage like a regular soda or something, or if it's artificially sweetened, you just really try to keep that to maybe just one a day or maybe two, but not this idea of continually taking in these sugar-free things in particular, because we really don't know in the long term what that does to the body. But if people get used to, it's still making you, whether it's sugar-free or not, you're wanting sweets. Mm-hmm. You're wanting something sweet to be in your system all the time. And kind of getting back again to foods and having it okay that you're not having something sweet all the time, I think is something we need to really look at. But the artificial sweeteners have been very helpful in a lot of ways to help with blood sugar control, and particularly people with diabetes. And for some people, they are really helpful for weight loss, because you can have a little something sweet if it's reasonable and small amount and feel like you finished your meal, but you're not getting mm-hmm. the calories. So if they're not overused, I think they can be really, really helpful. But the idea that you can just keep drinking things and keep eating things because they're sugar-free is, you know, I think something that is a big concern.
And I suppose here we could put in a word for the value of fruits.
Exactly.
Because they offer us some sweetness, but they also offer a lot of other good things for us.
Right. Often if you think of, you know, ending a meal with a piece of fruit or even a few slices of fruit, or I think maybe a typical, you know, going out to eat maybe at an Asian restaurant where you get oranges, oftentimes sliced oranges at the end of the meal, and how good those are. And you don't necessarily need any more dessert than that. You just need a few slices of those oranges, and boy, you feel like you finished off your meal. And that idea is something I think we do need to get back to, really utilizing fruit more. And there's no question that for a lot of people, if they have fruit throughout the day more, then maybe they're not going to be as apt to run for that candy bar or run for those other sweets, because they have gotten some of that natural sweet intake and carbohydrate that the body needs. But it's in a form where you're getting all these other fruits and vegetables. And that brings another point, too. We really are looking to try to help people take in more produce. And the caller who mentioned the sodium issue, which is a big concern, we also know that if people take in more potassium in general, that helps modulate blood pressure. And so if you're not only watching sodium, but if you really are trying to get in some more fruits and vegetables that are high in potassium, then we think that also plays a role, and getting enough calcium plays a role in blood pressure, and certainly even walking 20 minutes a day plays a role in blood pressure and keeping your weight down and all these other things besides the sodium intake.
Let's go and take another call. This is a listener in McLean County on line one. Hi.
Hi. Two questions, both about sweets. One, I've seen a candy sweetened with xylitol, which is supposed to be extracted, I think, from the beech tree. And according to the package, it does not require insulin to metabolize. I understand what you just said a few minutes ago about the more you eat sweets, the more you kind of expect sweets to fill your day. But I wondered if you knew any, if you had heard anything about xylitol that makes it perhaps less harmful for sugar, or better when one is trying to consume no sugar. And second, when it comes to artificially sweetened sodas, seems to me I recently read a brief article in the paper, so it wasn't terribly informative, but mentioning that there seems to be a link between people, a connection, not necessarily causation, between people who drink a lot of diet sodas and the increased risk of stroke and heart disease.
Okay. Well, let me get to your first question first, your question about xylitol, which is kind of a sugar alcohol, and that's what's in that type of sweeteners and a lot of sugar-free gums, where the body doesn't, it doesn't act like a real sugar, and it's a kind of a slower acting, very low calorie. And so as far as saying doesn't raise blood sugar, doesn't get, you know, broken down like it would with somebody with diabetes, that's true. It's, you know, often calorie free, And so that in that way, it, you know, is not going to be affecting insulin per se, because you don't have actual carbohydrate that has to break down. So that's a good thing. And again, I think the, you know, along with these other sweeteners, that's really helpful for diabetes, because the body then, you know, doesn't have too much carbohydrate, and that can affect, that can be really helpful with keeping blood sugars down. As far as drinking a lot of the sweetened sodas and maybe causing or maybe seeing a relationship with other problems, strokes, heart disease, those kinds of things, there's no question when you think about just the quality of food that you're taking in. And this is, this would be just as a broad, maybe a global recommendation for people when they're thinking about eating, is just that, is most of what I'm eating pretty high quality? Is most of it pure food? Is most of it really just food itself without being changed or modified or things like that? I think that is a good rule of thumb. And when you start getting in sweetened sodas at large amounts, we have a lot of things going on. A lot of times we have a lot more phosphorus that's added to the system, and that may play a role. We certainly have other preservatives that are added to the system. For some people, there is some sodium in some sodas, and that can affect it. So there probably could be a lot of things that, you know, might potentially cause trouble if you're drinking 4, 5, 6 diet sodas a day. And, you know, I've certainly known people to have 3 or 4 2-liter bottles of diet soda a day, just as a way to try to curb their hunger and keep them from eating as many things. And that much in one day, or certainly large amounts, what I would consider over 1 or 2 bottles or cans of soda a day, really is probably an amount where your quality of your total diet is going to go down, because that's a lot of fluid that is not necessarily going to be the best for you.
Does the listener want to follow up?
Thank you.
Okay.
No, I bet so. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this morning. This is Focus, and this morning we're talking about diet and nutrition with registered dietitian Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you're invited to join us with a phone call or by email with a question, with a comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. I wanted to, as long as we don't have anybody waiting at the moment, I thought I would share a couple of tips that I found. When
Great.
I came across this recommendation, I thought this was really good. Eat lots more vegetables and fruits, filling half your plate with them. For me, that's really easy to visualize.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then the thing is, okay, how do I make that happen day to day, meal to meal? And I found some interesting little tips that maybe I could share a couple
Great.
With. Add veggies you almost like to dishes you already love. Try them in soup. Slip them into salads. Increase the fun factor. Some vegetables are just more fun to eat than others, so corn on the cob is,
mm-hmm.
is fun. Veggie kebabs, celery sticks filled with natural peanut butter or light cream cheese. So,
great.
There's some good advice out there. And also, know how to cook the stronger flavored veggies. And I think that's a problem for some of us. It's like
mm-hmm.
some of us love Brussels sprouts and some of us hate them.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you find that right way to cook them,
mm-hmm.
and I'm seeing things out there more and more about how to handle those strong flavors, whether it might be roasting them.
Sure.
Cooking them very lightly.
Yes.
So that they don't go, ugh.
Right. You kind of get some of that stringency out of it.
Yeah.
And that is the key, because preparing yourself to have those foods around and trying those foods is really beneficial. I mean, we had a cooking class Monday for our athletes here at the U of I, and it was a noon class on stir fries. And probably one of the – they all had vegetables in them, of course. But one of the recipes that people liked the most was as simple as can be, and use something that all college students nearly all eat, which is ramen noodles. And you make ramen noodles first, you scramble a couple eggs to add in for protein, and you just steam cook or use a steam pack of at least 2 or 3 or 4 cups of vegetables and steam
mm-hmm.
that too, and you mix it all together.
And did they use the spice packet in the ramen?
And they used the spice packet in the ramen.
Because that's pretty salty.
Right. It's salty. But, of course, the athletes are going to need the salt.
Okay.
But if you made it yourself, you could use it with, you know, the low-fat ramen. Just use half a packet. And we also added some additional kind of a like an Asian spice mix that was just herbs in there, herbs and spices. That was really helpful. But that was a way where our athletes would say, well, I make ramen all the time, but I just eat the ramen. But now they know they can have double the vegetables in the ramen and a little egg for protein. And very inexpensive, very easy. And that would kind of go along with the idea that you already like something. So what can you add to it so that all of a sudden that's a pretty healthy option?
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Let's take a call next from a listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for this program. I was calling. I had a question. I was wondering if you can address the weight gain from psychotropic drugs and how's the best way to lose weight once you've gained it?
Thank you for that question. You know, many drugs will or can have the potential to, you know, cause weight gain. And sometimes that's related to an increase in appetite. Sometimes it's related to just how the body utilizes that medication and it affects metabolism or affects your body's ability to gain body fat. And a couple things I would suggest. One would be we know that the food group in general for most people that tends to be most satiating or helps us feel satisfied is protein. And so if you're on you know, some of the certain medications that might affect your hunger, might affect satiety, then I would really focus on adding a little more protein to each meal, simply because you might feel like it tides you over longer and you're not going to eat as many calories. And that might be, again, things like if you already have chicken in something, maybe add a little bit more or utilize a little bit more yogurt or milk or things like that, which would add some additional protein, because we know that that may help with that. And the other thing I would do is sometimes on those medications, if you're able to, and this is sometimes challenging, but able to get out and exercise and be more active, that really does help because that increases metabolism and increases the body temperature, and that can really help maybe counterbalance some of that weight gain. And then the other issue would be really the things that we've been talking about. If you go on those medications, another thing you may want to be prepared to do or do once you've, you know, been on it for a while is really boost the fruits and veggies, and especially vegetables, because vegetables, of course, are almost very, very low in calories and, you know, virtually calorie-free by the time you digest them. And so that might be a time to say I'm really going to increase, particularly things that are finger vegetables, because sometimes that really helps, having more carrots and cauliflower and broccoli and celery and things that you can just sort of grab and eat, peppers and things like that. So you're getting full. Maybe between that and the protein, you're getting more full, but your calorie level is really kind of going down a bit.
I had another question. There's a big thing about being gluten-free and, you know, even recommending that for weight control. Could you address that?
Well, I don't recommend people go on a gluten-free diet in general unless they have some type of gluten intolerance. There's not a lot of research to say that just eating gluten-free is going to necessarily cut down your calories enough. Now, what happens is people, if they're used to eating bread and cereal and these things and cookies and cakes and stuff like that, and they go gluten-free, they think, oh my gosh, I can't have wheat, so I'm not eating any of those foods, and they may drop calories simply because of that. But you wouldn't need to necessarily go gluten-free to do that. You might just say, wow, I'm going to really try to say most of what I eat is fruits and veggies and some protein, and then I'll just kind of cut down on my grains because they're just higher density calories. And I would say the recommendation might be better to do that rather than go gluten-free, simply because it's much easier to do, and then you could still include really healthy options in your diet that do have gluten. And that way you don't have to be so particular about all the sauces and everything else that might have some vinegar or have gluten in them. So that might be right, my recommendation. Certainly if somebody needs to be gluten-free, if they've had the testing done, they do have some problems with gluten, then it's a very helpful thing to do. But it's not really necessary unless you do have those concerns.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Next we go to Sullivan, line four. Hi.
Yeah. Can a person eat too many almonds? I like almonds and I just eat them like candy.
Well, I would say almonds are so good in terms of protein. They're good in good fats. They're helpful for you. But if they're salted, they have a lot of salt. So that might be one concern if they're salted. The other thing is because they're so high in fat, even though it's really good fat, they're very high in calories. So if you're watching calories or if you say, oh, my gosh, my weight's gone up. Sometimes people tell me I'm eating all these good nuts. But it's just a lot of calories. So if calories are not an issue, if your weight is good, if they're not all salted, those kinds of things, you're probably fine as long as you're getting enough of everything else too.
Okay, how about artificial sugar and whatever? If you use it like a couple packs a day in your cereal instead of sugar.
I wouldn't have any problem with using a couple packs a day. I think that's a reasonable amount. That's, you know, not too much to cause any trouble.
Okay, how much can coffee can a person consume without having trouble?
Well, coffee would depend on, you know, other risk factors. If you have any problem with digestion or heartburn or anything like that, you'd want to watch it. But most studies on coffee that show there is a benefit for even 3 to 4 cups of coffee a day. If you're drinking much more than that, you might want to look to say, am I drinking enough water? Am I drinking enough milk? Am I getting some of these other things in too? Coffee is kind of acidic, and it can over time cause some people to develop some problems with acidity, heartburn, problems with esophagus and things like that. So, but I'd say if you have 3 or 4 cups a day or so, that's probably a reasonable amount for you. And also the caffeine can be a concern if it's too much.
Okay. There we've got to wrap it up. We're at the end of the time in this hour that we have to spend today talking with Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move, and hope to see you come April.
Very good. It'll be all nice and warm, hopefully.
Let's hope. And this is Focus on WILL AM and at will.illinois.edu.